If you're going to have a great reset, how do you propose it to people?
Why, you have a great narrative.
That's the next step the global elites are working on. I'm John Lufter. The program is Steel on Steel.
Steel on Steel. News, commentary, interview, and debate. An alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Now, here's the host of Steel on Steel, John Loeffler.
You know, I have been wondering for quite some time how they're going to work themselves out of the little... It isn't a kerfuffle, it's a kerpickle. They've gotten themselves in quite a kerpickle internationally, and they've known that they were coming up on this moment, but it's nice to be able to bury it under something like the COVID pandemic. I'm talking about the financial reset worldwide. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Steel on Steel, taking the 30,000-foot view in economics, politics, and religion. News, commentary, interview, information, and debate, much of which you will not hear elsewhere. Our golden pledge for the last 31-plus years has been to be an early warning service to connect what are seemingly unrelated dots in the area of economics, politics, and religion, project seemingly unrelated trends, and then show you where exactly those trends are coming together just over the horizon, where normally the herd doesn't see it. Herd's almost always running in the wrong direction. That's because they're listening to establishment media types who are no longer providing news, but rather are purveyors of narrative. And what they do is they report some stories, not report others, report some facts, not report others. And since that's true, and for 31-plus years, we went on the air to be an antidote to that and an early warning service. Please do remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko. So, as I said, I've been sort of wondering how they're going to get themselves out of this kerpickle, because if they don't get themselves out of this kerpickle globally, they are going to be in a real kerfuffle. As populations in North America and Europe and elsewhere discover that inflation goes crazy. And it's going crazy simply because of the fact we have pumped so much liquidity into the system in one form or another that we knew it was going to cut loose at some point. We've probably never come closer to losing control of inflation in this country in times past, even when we were going through the crazy stuff during the Carter administration. And so, you know, they realize they have a problem. They have massive amounts of debt. There's massive amounts of public and private debt. They have to do something with it. It's probably unpayable. So how do you pay something that is unpayable? There are proposals for this. Say the Treasury creates a trillion-dollar coin or X trillion dollars and hands it off to the Fed and everybody else that owes debt and said, there, the debt is paid. Presto changeo, we did it. That's probably going to be one of their options. Always beware, because they always tend to roll problems like this onto the back of someone. Politicians will never take responsibility for the very damage that they have caused to you and to me, which is quite a bit right now, given the soaring prices that are going on out there. And you can always tell that they're going to do that ahead of time because they'll demonize the very people they're going to soak or try to soak. But in reality now, there's not enough people out there to soak, period. And I think they know that. So they will need, in order to deal with that, a great narrative to handle the Great Reset. Now, bear in mind that when we go through the Great Reset, which is going to be supported by the Great Narrative, it's always fun how this works. They will roll into that all sorts of little mischief they've wanted to do all along, like, number one, get rid of cash. Number two, lots of surveillance of people, all in the name, of course, of national security. And, of course, we have to worry about global warming. And so that will have to be factored into this nonsense. Number three, biometric identifiers rather than all of the ways we're doing things now. And it will go on. But in the midst of all of this, I should issue the caution, never underestimate their potential for creativity in terms of deeding to themselves more power. And so they'll pile on with that, and it'll be proposed to the public as a solution to the pain that the public are feeling. Why is the public feeling pain right now? The Build Back Better is really should be denominated Build Back Bankrupt. So in a time when we should be employing as many people as possible, we're paying people not to work, at least we've been doing it to a certain point there, and we've been firing people who don't want to take the COVID shot. So we're laying all sorts of people off, and then the hospitals say, we have a staffing shortage. Who could have seen that one coming, right? Meanwhile, they all just come back from the cop-out conference, cop-out 26. We're going to have our carbon emissions cut in half. Now, you have to look at this and say, what are you going to do here? And the answer is they're going to have to make make the price of energy very expensive. And we already see that. The price of energy has gone up. The price of everything else goes right up through the roof with it. And riding up on this wonderful sky launch that we're in is massive amounts of monetary inflation. The two are shaking hands and going, "Wee, isn't this going to be fun?" That's where we are. So they have to get themselves out of this pickle into which they have built themselves, but they will try to offload responsibility for that, all, of course, in the name of the public good, even though their actions have led to the public not so good. So in the interest of having our listeners not caught short by all of this or running around yelling, "What's going on now? I don't understand it," we'll talk a little about this. Pat Wood is with me today, executive director and founder of Citizens for Free Speech. You know, we're going to talk about the great narrative, which they are trying to push forward as a part of the Great Reset. Now, this would, of course, mean something that the media and the politicos and everybody else who's correct with this, they will all use the same scripts in delivering this message going forward. However, as we're wandering into that, Pat, I noticed looking around the world, whether it's Poland saying we're not taking any more migrants and that's the end of that, we don't care what the European Union says, to the issues on our own border, to the fact that the COP26 meeting on global warming was a giant blah, blah, blah fest, as Greta Thunberg has so aptly identified. The narratives are collapsing even at the time they're trying to create new narratives. Now, this is an oddity to me. So where do you think this is going?
Well, first off, the need for the great narrative, I think, tells a little bit of a story about where they are internally within their own echo chamber. And I think what this kind of says to me, and this is a new thing. We know they've had propaganda. They've had that for years. And the propaganda war has increased. We know that the World Economic Forum have experts on staff creating propaganda and sending it all over the planet. But the thought that they now need to go public with this concept, hey, we all need to get together and have this great narrative, all get on the same page, et cetera, tells me that they're upping the game. And I'm not sure exactly how successful they're going to be, but remembering that they have access to virtually all the money in the world, including money in the Mideast, like in Dubai, for instance, they have the means to do a lot of trouble, you know, make a lot of trouble. And this great narrative, I expect, is going to be nothing more than the propaganda they've been spitting out. But I think they just want to make sure everybody's lined up and they're working on the same team.
Let me ask a question. As we see these smaller narratives, such as unlimited migration, prosperity by taxation and inflation, we could go down the list. As these are unraveling, is this great reset an attempt to get ahead of the chaos that is rapidly moving in our direction?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. You know, and I can say almost with great certainty right now that whatever the great narrative is going to be, we'll know pretty soon when they publicize it. But whatever it's going to be, you can bet that if you violate or anybody violates this great narrative, you're going to be the target of misinformation, disinformation, and probably persecution. And if you live in Australia, they might throw you in jail and throw away the key. This is going to be the standard by which everything else is measured. To me, that's probably the most dangerous thing about this right now. Once this is published and made known, if this becomes the de facto world great narrative that goes along with a great reset, then you buck it, you're going to be in big trouble.
Now, obviously, a lot of this is going to rotate around climate change, and we've just seen another cop-out over the whole issue of it. It's real clear Russia and China, no shows. They're enjoying the West, watch it take itself apart over creating energy crises that need not be. People will reject that because of the cost. It's contributing in major part to the inflation that we're seeing. But they're going to try to weave this one in. So what will the narratives be? And we could probably go all the way back to Gro Harlem Brundtland. Remember that? Going back, what, 20, 30 years? We're going to see the resurgence of things like sustainability, biodiversity. You know, there are all these buzz words.
Well, I think they've already said what the narrative is going to be, at least a little bit. Here's one of the press releases or something that Klaus Schwab said about it anyway. He said, "The Great Narrative Initiative and meeting in Dubai will be a powerful catalyst to shape the contours of a more prosperous and inclusive future for humanity that is also more respectful of nature." I'll translate that simply to say Klaus Schwab loves sustainable development. He loves the United Nations. I don't think for a minute he believes it all necessarily, but he loves it because it achieves his agenda. And this is where they're headed: shaping the contours of a more prosperous and inclusive future for humanity. He didn't ask you and I don't think, John, to vote on this new humanity. I never had any input to it. So it must be something that they have cooked up themselves. And indeed, I think that's the case.
So that's the need for the narrative so that the rest of us, the unwashed masses, get in line behind the, quote, experts.
That's right. And of course, if they said it, I guess they figure we have the responsibility and duty to just go along with it. You know, it's like we do have the PhDs after all, and we are trillionaires after all, and we have almost every major global corporation in the world behind us on this. You know, why wouldn't you believe us? This is gaslighting on a global scale at this point. I hate to use that word in a sense, but I think people are catching on to what that means. Somebody suggested, in fact, I think it was James Dellingpole said that what's going on in Glasgow with the COP26 conference is just a giant gaslighting operation, trying to convince people that something is real that is not. And you keep pounding them until they finally think we must be going insane because it just doesn't work anymore.
If we go back to 1987, remember Our Common Future came out. This was the blueprint for the Rio conference that happened 5 years later. We really saw a lot of all of this kick off back then. It was chaired, I mentioned her before, by Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was former Prime Minister of Norway and previously Minister of the Environment in that country. She's also a member of the Trilateral Commission. Surprise, surprise, right?
Yep.
Same suspects always come up. We pretty much heard the same rhetoric back then. At that time, they weren't quite screaming as loudly as they are about global warming. They were screaming about a whole bunch of things. Remember when Vice President Al Gore wrote Earth in the Balance, he buckshotted everything, just listing all of the different things that were wrong. Somewhere, global warming took off as the poster child of all of this. A lot of the other things have been forgotten. But what were the goals back then? Pretty much the same as now?
Well, many of them were people that analyzed Agenda 21, for instance. The book that they published was very clear. I think it had 40 chapters or something in it and 275 pages. It was a very clear book, said what they were going to do. The Biodiversity Convention ran in parallel to Agenda 21, and that was very clear, too. They produced about a 1,200 or 1,300-page book. The whole concept of sustainable development was relatively new at that time. I believe, and documented in my book, that this really was warmed over technocracy from the 1930s, a resource-based economic system. Their goal was to control all the resources of the world, basically. What people missed, me included, was the importance they placed on humans as being part of those resources. I never really quite thought of it that way, even 20 years ago. But now, you know, more stuff has come to the surface, more information has been discovered and stuff about what really went on back then in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. And yes, it was sustainable development. Yes, it was Agenda 21 and all the other things that we've known about it. But now we see what an important role that the biotechnical industry and big pharma played at that time. And I don't think anybody really, really paid attention to that at the time. So this is kind of a new angle. I know you're alluding to an article that I wrote called Global Blueprint Exposed, the Takeover of All Genetic Material on Earth.
Well, that's a great segue. Let's get to it. But it's really true because there was a companion piece, not of this article, but I just read from the Canadian government looking at biodigital is what they're talking about now, the three stages of biodigital integration. But let's look at yours because I think these things are all running parallel to each other.
They absolutely are. And when you have an eyewitness like from 1992 that was willing to say what they saw or write what they saw, but they're not on our side, right? They're kind of the old time environmentalists from the 50s and 60s and 70s. These guys were eyewitnesses. They were not necessarily friendly to most of our positions, but they discovered that, or at least they believed, that the whole Agenda 21 conference was a big fraud. And they were very outspoken about it. And they also wrote, incidentally, in their book that they finally produced called The Earth Brokers in 1994, they also wrote about the Biodiversity Convention, which, as I said, ran in parallel with Agenda 21. It was the same place, same town, same people, but they had two tracks going on at the same time. That happens in conferences, by the way, all the time, even today. So they wrote in their book, this is a direct quote, The main stake raised by the Biodiversity Convention, not a little stake, but the main stake, is the issue of ownership and control over biological diversity. The major concern was protecting the pharmaceutical and emerging biotechnology industries. That's just stunning that they would say something like this. And they didn't write a chapter on it. You know, it's just a mentioned it along the way. But the reason they brought it up is because the term biodiversity had been redefined by the Convention on Biodiversity. And you and I don't know, I'll speak for me. I used to think biodiversity, you know, you had something to do. You walk out in the forest or the jungle and, oh, look at all those great species of animals and lizards and frogs or whatever. And, you know, the trees. Isn't it wonderful? It's a diverse world. That's not what they defined back in 1992. They said in their book, these Earth Broker people, they said the convention implicitly equates the diversity of life, that is animals and plants, we're an animal, to the diversity of genetic codes for which read genetic resources. By doing so, diversity becomes something that modern science can manipulate. Finally, the convention promotes biotechnology as being, quote, essential for the conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity. So they really let the cat out of the bag here, that the word has been redefined. They let everybody else go along with the wrong view of the word. But to them, internally, it had everything to do with genetic manipulation.
And or the cataloging of all genetic material on Earth. And then is that part of the global commons?
Yes.
And tied in with that is ownership of private property, which they keep talking against.
Yes. The goal here, and I've said this for years, regardless of what I'm saying right here about Biodiversity Convention, the goal since 1973 has been to take over all of the physical resources of our planet. That was clear even back in the 70s. We just didn't know how they're going to do it yet. Now I have a pretty good idea what's going on here. But the fact that human genetic code is being included in this so-called global commons is just absolutely disturbing. And this didn't start last year. It started in earnest back in 1992. And now they're talking about the digital sequence information of all genetic resources on the planet. Everything that has genetic code will be analyzed, cataloged, computed. AI will figure out how everything works, and then they will be able to create literally synthetic life. This is a monster that I didn't quite see clearly, even though I've been talking about transhumanism for years. I don't know, going back, wow, way back 10, 12, 15 years, I don't know.
Yeah.
But now we have a new view of transhumanism and how it is playing into this whole idea of creating humanity plus or humanity 2.0 by the modification of genetic codes. And people that still scoff at this, you look at how many seeds have been engineered, like Monsanto, for instance. You look at all the insects that have been modified, like the mosquitoes down in Florida. They're going to wipe out some disease down there. And then you look at the animals that have been genetically modified. And yeah, okay, they're looking at growing implants for humans now and pigs. And they're looking at double-muscled cattle and pigs. And pigs that glow in the dark. And animals have been modified tremendously so far. Humans are the last item on the menu for them. And now we see the world is being injected with messenger RNA and with DNA, so-called vaccines. Wouldn't somebody connect the dot here, John, and say, wait a minute, what is going on here and how does this play into the bigger plan?
Well, but let's back up. Remember, humans are the product of evolution. Therefore, we are no different than the animals.
Yes.
And that's where we saw the shift when you said human resources. Remember, it used to be personnel, the personnel department, referring to individual persons. But then it became human resources, which means humans are a resource to be managed just like everything else on the earth. No better, no worse. That's a red flag there. The cataloging of the DNA and the interfacing of it, that's just a furtherance of that same concept. It's not a biblical concept, that's for sure.
Well, this is kind of like the Tower of Babel is being erected right in front of our eyes. It's just that they haven't started the vertical building yet, I guess. But, you know, taking over all of life on Earth spits in God's face, that's for sure, because he is the author of life. He's the author, you know, of everything that we have in the whole universe. And yet these people are bent on doing it better than God did. And that's exactly what they say in their literature. Say, we can do a good job at recreating humanity and recreating nature and recreating biodiversity. Just give us a few years in a laboratory with a big old IBM computer or something, and we will figure out the technological solution to recreate, reform the world in our own image. And of course, yes, this does literally spit in God's eye, because it's the pinnacle of what man can do. This is humanism on steroids. You could call it scientific humanism, I suppose. What man can do, and man doesn't need God to do it, man can do it.
Should be interesting. All right, so what's the next step? Where do we go from there? They're going to come out with a narrative. We're not quite sure what it's going to look like. We have an idea of what its goals are going to be. The real question is this divergence that we are seeing worldwide? People are finally, well, not just waking up, but verbally protesting despite the censorship we see going on social media sites right now. There's a growing chorus of people in various countries who are recognizing that something is amiss. Will that derail it? I think those are the challenges ahead.
Yes, it really is. And people, you know, the only thing that stands in their way, I suppose, are the people of the world, the individual citizens of different countries. We see protests mounting up all over the world. I don't know that protests by themselves are going to solve anything, but at least it demonstrates public sentiment. And we see that everywhere. And we see little pieces of the old narrative coming apart, like Italy, for instance, renumbering their death count. You remember how bad off they said they were last year in 2020. They said now, well, surprise, surprise, over 97% of the people that we said died from COVID didn't die from COVID. They died with COVID, but not from it. And only 3% of the people that died, died from COVID exclusively. It's like a big change. Well, yeah, people in Italy, I'm sure, are looking at that and saying, hey, wait a minute. We went through all this pain and suffering because you did it all wrong? That doesn't wash. You know, the people are very upset with their governments right now. But in the end of it, what's going to make a difference to derail it and stuff? This is still unknown. It's going to take a change in our behavior, I think, to combat it. And the reason I say that is because the one thing that technocrats and transhumanists want is predictability. They want everything to be absolutely predictable according to their AI programs or whatever. And if they say it's going to be a certain way, they want it to be that way. When people act in an unpredictable manner, which they are prone to do, as you know, this drives them crazy. It just, they can't handle it. And so when a Rand Paul, for instance, just absolutely berails Anthony Fauci in senatorial committee, Fauci just sits there and looks at him and blinks his eyes and I just don't understand why you're so upset, Senator Paul. It's like, oh my gosh, these people have a hard, hard head, and getting through to them is going to be very difficult. But right now they have the upper hand.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely there. It's the same thing as we've seen in these school board meetings, which have been confrontational around the country, is for 30 years, the educrats have promised us reform. The reform never happened. They just carry the agendas further and further. In many cases, they lied to parents or concealed from parents what was going on. Then when the parents catch on to it and confront them, they go, well, we're not doing that. We never did do that. When the parents point out that they did, if you notice, the school boards are always trying to make it the problem of the parents who have uncovered what it is the educrats have been doing. And that's what really makes you mad about the whole thing.
It really does. And, you know, we used to joke, I think we talked about this maybe once, John, but we used to joke about the Soviet Union back during the Cold War. Whenever the Soviets would say something, you knew that that's exactly what they were doing. When they would make a charge against us doing something, it was them that was doing it, not us. And it became a joke in political science circles. You know, well, you know, what are they saying we did this week? Now we know what they're doing this week. The whole thing right now, the blame that's being placed on everybody else is 180 degrees out of tune with what's really happening. All the fingers should be pointed at them, not at people. So when parents now are accused of being domestic terrorists and guilty of hate crimes because they're sometimes calling the school board members' names, which you can understand why they do that. But, you know, the fact is the tyrants are sitting behind the panel bench They're not in the audience. They're not the parents sitting in the audience. The tyrants are the ones sitting behind the wood-paneled podium where all their decisions are being made.
Yeah, it's really true. But you know what you have to do? You simply have to plow through with the truth.
Yes.
You just keep on going. You know, yes, they're going to call you names. Yes, they're going to do this. It always reminds me of what I call the Irish Catholic mother syndrome, of which I had one. They would always pick on you. They'd pick, well, you didn't do this. Well, one right after the other. So these little nags and jabs and stuff like that. And when finally you get mad and you go, bah, and you bark back, what did I do? I used to say, you know, all of us cousins used to say about our mothers who all came from the same family, we could feel our fists balling up, you know, you want
yep.
Because it was hypocritical. That's what it drove you nuts. It was that type of thing. Yeah, it's the thing we laugh about, status. Anyway. All right. Pat Wood, executive director and founder of Citizens for Free Speech and editor-in-chief of Technocracy News, websites and or blogs.
Well, we are at citizensforfreespeech.org for our nonprofit operation, which we are the nation of defenders, if you will, against censorship. And we're trying to keep the First Amendment alive and free speech alive. It's a hard job right now, as you know. My professional site, of course, is technocracy.news, and all things technocracy are found over there. We're trying to take action at Citizens for Free Speech to do something about it. And by the way, we just released a brochure on propaganda that people are finding very interesting right now. It's how to understand and debunk propaganda, like what we're talking about right now. This will come in handy for the great narrative when it finally comes out.
Should be interesting, yeah. I did remember that. I remember, too, when, say, for example, smart growth and other things come to your town, which is nothing but a rework of Agenda 21, and somebody points out that it's Agenda 21. They say, well, that's conspiracy theory. Well, it's in your book. You wrote about it here. It's in your book. Why are you denying it now? It's really nutso. All right, Pat Wood, let's see what comes out of the conferences, and we'll track the career of Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum, because they're trying to plot our future in the world, even as here in this country we're worried about all this little diddlem stuff we're arguing about. So appreciate your time.
My pleasure, John. Anytime.
What you're watching on one phase, remember, things happen at multiple levels, and too many people try to see it as a linear situation where everything's on one plane happening, and therefore they try to squash everything together. Linear thinkers never get it as to what's happening, because life is actually three-dimensional. So the progressive socialist narratives are collapsing as we look at them. But they're being propped up by the media on one side as they collapse on the other. The media prop them up. The social media censor them up, meaning anybody who points out the fact that they're really in serious trouble and not working are themselves censored. And, you know, the classic cliches come up. But if you notice, there's this giant backswell of people that is really predominant in the United States, less so elsewhere in the Anglosphere. But there's this giant backswell that people are sick to death of it. They recognize that it's nonsense or toxic as it goes, and they're protesting against it regardless. So on one hand, that's happening. The same thing with the COP26. Blah, 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 goes Greta Thunberg. She's recognized. Remember, she's a tier two person. Tier one is the average everyday person just living his life. Tier two are the true believers. Tier three are the power, money, and control crowd who use the tier two people to get what they want. And tier four is the spiritual dimension behind it. Well, she's a tier two, and she's discovered that all of the people up in tier three really aren't that as on fire to stop global warming as she is. And she's actually saying we have to have even more drastic cuts and more drastic action. Yeah, right. Ain't going to go nowhere, Greta. The only way they're going to do it is if they can get tax money out of it. And indeed, the United Nations is back saying once more, we need some kind of a global penalty, carbon tax. The United Nations has been trying to get independent taxation for decades so they can become a de facto self-functioning government by themselves. That's the purpose. The other thing is simply a vehicle. So on one hand, you're watching the collapse of these narratives, notably Poland saying, stop, that's it. We're not taking anymore. Belarus is not going to shove these migrants across the border and force them into the European Union from the old Soviet Union, ironically. And that's going to stop. Hungary already did so, for which they were excoriated by all of the ideologues. Even as the ideologues in the West are telling us about biodiversity and saving energy, they have made themselves hideously vulnerable to Russia by being dependent on its natural gas. U.S. because the Grünen, the wild-eyed Green Party in Germany, ran around and made them shut down their nuclear power plants. None of this makes any sense whatsoever. What it is it's the narrative, the ideology, smashing itself down on the reality as the reality is now breaking up and becoming real. That's one side. The other side is this new great narrative, the Great Reset narrative, that the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab and others are trying to push. It follows in the line of Build Back Better, which leaders throughout the Anglosphere have been using ever since the pandemic just handed them a golden opportunity. So the question now is, will the great narrative be the effort to get out and around this whole situation? That remains to be seen, because there is an economic day of reckoning coming. They have to get out ahead of this. Look at where even now we're talking about putting on more internal revenue agents. Oh, great. That's what we need. More audits, more taxes, more this, more that, and everything. But that is the history of what happens before things break in the process of a reformation. It's a familiar pattern. So we shouldn't be surprised by that. But that's the tension that we see growing right now, the disparity between the narratives and reality and the attempt to bring a new narrative to get ahead of that realistic collapse of the old narratives, even if they're folding in some of the old narratives. It's an interesting piece of artwork, and it remains yet to be seen. But it will affect us. That's why we cover it here on the show. Remember, God remains eternal. We're just passing through. So yes, things are going to be a little roller coastery for a while. That's okay. God has a plan for your and my life. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller, I'm John Loeffler. We're at steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel. I don't know if I ever tell my listeners, I had an interesting experience. I was giving a long-term talk one night to a group of several hundred people about the Marxist roots of American public education, starting with John Dewey and his love of the Soviets and how he went to the Soviet Union. And I get done, and these three guys, I'm only 5'7". I'm well built, but, you know, I mean, 5'7", I was doing a lot of mixed martial arts at the time. And these three guys surround me, and I'm thinking, oh, crud, here it goes now. They're probably school teachers. I'm in for it. And I'm thinking, all right, the guy next to me, I'm going to shin kick him. That'll be my first takedown. And then I'm going to pivot and take the guy next to him before everybody realizes what's happened and take this guy down with a knee to the groin. And then I'll figure out what to do about number three. But they begin talking to me in Russian accents. And they said to me, you are right. This is Soviet system. We grew up in Siberia. We know what it looks like. What we came here to get away from it. They're in their late 30s. We don't understand why you Americans have it here. Now, I was just stunned. Jim Simpson is joining me right now, investigative journalist and former economist and budget examiner for the White House Office of Management and Budget under Presidents Reagan, Bush 1, and Clinton. Well experienced in the Cloward-Piven strategy of manufactured crisis, and his newest book is Who Was Karl Marx? The Man, the Motives, and the Menace Behind Today's Rampaging American Left. You know what I found, Jim? When you talk to people, even if you look at this pastor in Calgary, Artur Pavlovsky, who is opposing the mandates and has been arrested I don't know how many times and put on how many charges, he grew up in communist Poland. He knows what he's looking at. He said, I've seen this before. I know the language, the verbiage. These men that surrounded me, this was 20 years ago, they had seen it, they knew it, and they knew I was telling the truth. But the other teachers who were there in the room just sort of go, oh, wow, we've never heard this before.
Yeah, right.
How did we ever get
to... back to doing what they're doing, and they don't even...
Don't even know that, yeah. I also did another presentation one time where I had three hats. I had one for Marxism and one for a biblical worldview. I think that was the white one or the green one. And I would change hats. And I said, you see, on Sunday, many of our Christian teachers in the public school system put on their Christian hat. But on Monday, they take that one off and they put on their Karl Marx, John Dewey hat. They have literally swapped worldviews and they don't even realize they've done it. How did we ever get to where we are in this culture? They kept telling us, Jim, communism's been defeated. Really? It's alive and well in China and it's alive and well in academia today.
Yeah, no, actually, it's alive and well. In fact, growing in leaps and bounds all over the world. Whoever actually bought into that whole mantra that communism had collapsed, they were fools, frankly. It's everywhere, and we haven't paid attention because honestly, we haven't had to pay attention. We've been affluent. We've been enjoying our affluence, our American lifestyles, and all of the benefits that have come with the most successful experiment in government ever created. And we've become lackadaisical. We've been so preoccupied with ourselves and our lives and everything that's going on, we haven't paid attention. And, you know, most people are like that. I don't think it's even new. I think it's actually biblical. You know, the book of Judges is all about that same thing, where people got complacent and they got comfortable. They didn't feel any threat from anywhere, and so they just went back to doing what they always did, which was run lives according to whatever it was they felt was most important to make them happy and satisfied right now, and not looking beyond their own navels to see what's going on. And I think, unfortunately, that's a human condition, and people have to be basically scorched. They have to really start to hurt before they come to their senses and start asking questions, what the heck is going on?
And then I find they usually tend to arrive late in the battle, which you find in change agentry. The change agents are ready for the first reaction. If you go to formal change agentry, where they anticipate the reaction and they use that reaction against you. It's like a jiu-jitsu fighter using your own energy against you.
Yep.
Unless you understand the rules, then you can come in and get ahead of the game, and you can short-circuit them, of course, by forcing them to throw their cards on the table. That's the one thing they don't want to do, is unmask what they're doing and throw their cards on the table. That gives it away. And once you do that, the game's all over for them.
Yeah, well, and as I describe and explain in my book, which, by the way, the last chapter, which is titled Back from the Brink, A Comprehensive Plan to Save America, the longest chapter in the book, I point out that very thing. We have forced them, Donald Trump and those who support him, I'd say the majority of Americans who support at least the things that he was doing and trying to do, forced the left into emergency mode, where they have actually had to come out and show their hand. They have become our best salesmen. And that was most recently reflected in the trouncing given to Terry McAuliffe in the race for governor of Virginia. We are, I think, the state legislature, the state house, gained either brought it up to where there's as many Republicans as there are Democrats. But this was a blowout, and it was directly the consequence of what Joe Biden has been doing, what Governor Ralph Northam had been doing in Virginia over the last 4 years that are just beyond the pale, outrageous. People are finally starting to wake up. You see that with all of the people coming out in school board meetings. I mean, a little, and it's extremely late because, as you know, that stuff has been going on in public schools for decades, getting worse and worse, but it's nothing new. But finally, people say, wait a minute, you're stealing our kids from us. Yes, we've been doing that successfully for about 50 years, and you're just noticing now, but at least we're noticing.
So how did we get to this point? And I always start with a branch off. It was sort of a confluence of different fellow travelers. You had the early secular humanist movement. John Dewey was a signatory to Humanist Manifesto 1. You also had the Frankfurt School is the big fickle finger. Frankfurt and Leipzig schools. We don't talk about Leipzig as much. But
right,
the big fickle finger points right at them because they came here, set up shop in the teachers' colleges, changed their name from the Institute for Marxist Research to the Institute for Social Research. Right. Changed the name and then began to infiltrate. And by the early 50s, they had control of it all. And that's where the changes began. It's still Marxism, though.
Oh, no. Absolutely hardcore communism. And I would say that, you know, most of the Frankfurt School professors, they were Comintern agents. I mean, they weren't just merely pointy-headed professors that believed in Marxism. These were people that were part of the Communist International. These were people dedicated to destroying the West as part of the Soviet Union's overall plan to do so. So they were the heart of this Soviet strategy to destroy America, to undermine their number one enemy by subverting and corrupting our culture, all aspects of our culture. So That's nothing new, and they've been very successful. I mean, practically every single movement that's happened in the United States, from the sexual revolution to all the things that have gone on in our schools, critical theory, critical race theory, all of these things come directly out of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, the critical race theory was just a revamp of the former communist class theory, which, remember, in the 50s was getting no traction, because I remember the 50s. There was just this exuberance after World War II. Prosperity was rampant and optimism was high. So that's why they switched. As soon as the civil rights movement came along, they said, oh, look, here's a vehicle we can ride on. So they hijacked Martin Luther King's movement and off they went.
Well, I'll tell you, that may have happened, but critical theory in the Frankfurt School was birthed in the 1930s after they got to Columbia Teachers College. But it comes directly out of the mind of Marx when he said, even before he wrote the Communist Manifesto, and this always struck me, he said, the issues of the day are not our concern. Wait a minute, what? I thought communism was the answer to all the issues of the day. He said, no. The issues of the day are not our concern. Our concern is a ruthless criticism of everything existing, and we will not shy away no matter the consequences, which meant basically he was saying, we're looking to destroy Western civilization. Nothing's going to stop us. And that was the heart of critical theory, because the Frankfurt School communists took a cue from what Marx had said, and critical theory is nothing less than ruthless criticism of everything about the West that exists. And that's where it comes from. And then there's dozens of critical theories downstream of critical theory today, and they're all just divide and conquer strategies, but parsed out into ever smaller segments of society so that they can create not one or two divisions, but dozens of divisions pitting us against ourselves.
And so, for example, racism is just what I call the vehicle at the moment that they're riding in.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, there's Noel Ignatiev, who with Ted Allen created the concept of white privilege, which is their Maoist communist way of separating and dividing us by race and making whites the enemy. But as I pointed out in the book, it doesn't matter what race you are, what color you are. If blacks were the majority in this country, it would be black privilege. And it's because they want to look at the component, the majority in this country, and make them into everybody's enemy so that the majority will not have any power against whatever it is what they want to do. And, you know, the whole thing is a joke. It frustrates me to no end to see conservatives engaged with the left on debating the validity of critical race theory when the whole point is to create division and divide us, turn us all into haters of each other. There is nothing beyond that. So the minute you start to debate the validity of the things that they're suggesting, you've just walked into their trap and you're right in the middle of their playing field, and you've already given it the air of legitimacy, which doesn't deserve anything, doesn't deserve no legitimacy. It's a strategy to undermine and destroy our country and set us at each other's throats. You go beyond that, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, as Chuck Missler used to say, and I've used it a lot of times here on the show, you can't win, you can't break even, and you can't get out of the game. And so you're now down to just one alternative, don't play. And say, I'm not even going to deal with this. We're just not accepting it. End of story. Because as soon as you get lost in the debate, you get lost in the weeds, you lose track of exactly where everything is going. You're right. That's exactly where it goes.
And also, you give it legitimacy. It deserves no legitimacy whatsoever. You know, the debate, the pretense of the entire argument is a put on. They don't believe it any more than we do. They know it's a put-on, but it's designed to tie us down and force us into conflict with one another. I think in my book I describe a lot of the various radicals over the decades who have articulated and improved on these various strategies. And the whole goal is to paint us into such a small corner that we have really two alternatives. One is to just throw our hands and give up, and the other is to revolt. And, of course, what they want is revolt, because once people revolt, that's when they clamp down. And, I mean, the January 6th protest was a perfect example of that, although I'm provocation by them. We didn't, of ourselves, decide to break into the Capitol. There was a small group of people connected to the left who provoked that whole thing and suckered a bunch of fools into walking into the Capitol and following their lead. And that just gave them the justification to say, this is the worst thing since 9/11. I mean, what a joke, but that was the goal. And that's just a small taste of the kind of communist provocations that they've been engaging in every single day since Obama was elected.
Well, people have begun to see what's happening. Again, a lot of times they're reacting to the vehicle. The lockdown under COVID has, ironically, had the benefit of letting parents see what's going on in the curricula in their kids' schools. That's a terrific start.
Yep.
They're reacting to the vehicle. It takes a while to get them more deeply understanding what I call the LRA, the long-running agenda. We had somebody try to bring in Agenda 21 into our county here. It took about 24 months to run it out, to make county just chock full of conservatives to say, look, this is not your plan like they're telling you. This is a big agenda. It's rolling here. And sure enough, the media go, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory. But then when you pull out the documents and say, look, here's a county in Maryland, look at the documents. Here's a county in Maine, look at the documents. They're the same. Then they go, wow. So here we are. People are arriving late to this battle. What's just a hint of your plan? I know you put it in the book.
Well, first of all, we don't fight together very well. You know, we are individualists, and so we have our particular issues, our particular battles. And getting us all onto the same page to fight a unified battle is herding cats. You know, that's one problem we have. But the bigger issue is that a lot of us feel like we have to go head-to-head with these people, and it never works out because they basically own most of the levers of power. They have successfully infiltrated most of the institutions of culture. Unless you have a law enforcement investigation that flushes them out and shows the criminal activity they're engaged in, you're not going to get them out of those institutions. So instead of trying to swim upstream in the middle of the river, the idea is to sidestep it and create more attractive alternatives, which people will naturally gravitate to, especially now that they're seeing just how radical and insane the left's agenda really is and how destructive it is. And I can't think of a better example. And of course, Ron DeSantis in Florida, who is making Florida a welcoming state, the kind of state you wish the entire country was like. And the entire country was turning in that direction, although it's kind of like turning the Titanic or something, but making America, making their alternative more attractive. And people are flooding to it because everything the left does is destructive and people are starting to see it. The more we can do that, the more people we can put in positions of power who will do the things that need to be done. For example, state schools. All the state schools get huge funding from the states. Well, if you have a governor in the state legislature that says, listen, unless and until you drop all of the garbage you're teaching and return to the traditional roles of the university, we're just not going to subsidize you. We're just going to discontinue funding you. And they will panic. Their board of directors will find good people. I mean, just things like that that can be done without actually having to battle head on these well-funded radical left institutions of our culture.
All right, James Simpson, latest book, Who is Karl Marx? The Men, the Motives, and the Menace Behind Today's Rampaging American Left. And I always point out the difference, by the way, between what I call the traditional left versus what we're seeing in progressivism today. Progressivism is the neo-Marxism.
Yeah, it's communism.
It's communism. It's just pure communism. You're fighting uphill against social media, against academia, which is now just totally controlled by it.
Right.
And it tolerates no dissent, if you notice.
Right. You got to sidestep it and replace it.
You got to sidestep it. Okay, so that is the book. I'm assuming it's available at the normal book outlets.
Yeah, it's available at Amazon, Abe Books, Goodreads. Go to my website, crisisnow.net, and there's a direct link to the Amazon page where you can get it. And it's been a bestseller for a while.
Crisisnow.net. All right, James Simpson, appreciate it.
Thanks so much, John.
Okay, so what do we take away from all of that? There are four levels at which all of this is happening. The first level is your average right-winger, left-winger. They sort of vote candidly, but they're about their ideas and their lives. They don't really understand what's happening. The true believers, these are the ones who think it's about saving the planet, global warming, polluting the oceans, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter. We could go down the list. These are just vehicles. They're the vehicles that in each point the Marxists choose to ride because it's a convenient vehicle. It covers the longer-term running agenda underneath. The third level, those are the true believers in the Marxist ideology, and those people understand it's power, money, and control, and it ultimately comes down to power, money, and control. And the fourth level, and this is the one that you can't forget, this is the spiritual dimension. This is orchestrated. That's why there really is a conspiracy. The conspiracy has existed since the beginning, in which Satan is orchestrating everything toward his magnum opus, as it is described in the book of Revelation. Notably, by the way, I would say chapters 13 and that particular area there. The first part deals with the churches at the end times. The second part deals with the judgments at the end times. Hold on a second. Oops, wait a minute. I have to admit, I forgot the four horse dudes in the first part of Revelation, before we get to the interesting part, as I call it, for modern times. So we go through the seven churches, conditions of the churches at the end times. Then you get to the four horse dudes with the seal judgments. We have three sets of seven judgments each. But it gets really interesting as you get into the end times, chapters 12 and 13, when you have the dragon and the various beasts that arise from the dragon and the Antichrist, and no one can buy or sell without the mark on the hand. No, it's not something you take accidentally as a chip. No, you don't suddenly lose your salvation. This is a mark that as you take it, you are being initiated into a Luciferian system just in order to survive. So this does not happen by accident. When you take this, you know what you're doing. It's a willful initiation into something. So we see all of this, and the beast talking, knowing what everybody does, seemingly working signs and wonders. Some of it is supernatural. Some of it's probably artificial intelligence, blah, 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 blah. You can see it all, and it finally says, who can make war with the beast? And it's a point that he wins over everything for just a skunch of time. The Bible says this is a call for the patience and the faith of the saints. That's what you're doing during that time, because it's just so bad. All you can do is hunker down. Okay, zoom out. Zoom into where we are here now. The mission of the church never changes. Go forth, make disciples, basically tell the truth. The mission never changes, and that will never change even during that time. But we are in a point where truth is at a premium nowadays. We are pitching into a world transformation here, where very few suspect where we're going, but you can see very clearly if you understand the dynamics based on things in the past, and yet there are things of the new. That's the statue of Daniel, remember? You had toes of clay and iron. Some things are hard and they can't be moved. Others are brittle and somehow it's all squished together. That's what this new globalism is all about. Today, we can see this. Remember in the book of Daniel, at the end of Daniel, Daniel's finally upset by everything he's seen over a period of time. And he finally says, tell me, what is it all this stuff means? This is really spooky stuff. And he is told, never you mind, for these predictions are yet many days hence to come. But go your way, and you will stand in your allotted place at the end of time. What does that mean? You did your part. You did it well. You have an allocated place in the kingdom at the end of time. But the prophecies were meant for one group of people only. Those people who live in those times would need these guidelines because things would get just so dicey and so messy that if they didn't have hope, like Jesus said, if the times had not been shortened, no flesh would survive. Faith would not survive. And that's why we have these texts. And today, those of us now who have come through the 20th century can look back and say, wait a minute, I see it all forming. So back up to where we are. Whether or not we're careening into that immediacy of that time, that remains to be seen. The core thing is, I get emails from people, they're ranting about this and raving about that. Stop it. Expect it. Understand it, and then witness as you need to what is going on to help people who don't understand. Don't fight stupid battles. Don't die on stupid hills. And if you are going to fight a battle and stand on a hill, whatever this is, understand the cost. Because there will be a cost. But I did say one thing years ago, you know what, if you're a longtime listener, said when the New World Order makes its final dash for the finish line, it's going to have to rip off all of its clothes and go running bare butt down the track and be seen exactly for what it is. But then they're going to realize what it is. And the spectators will have to jump out of the stands and run like heck and try to tackle it before it gets to the finish line. That is where you and I are right now. And each of us has a role. We have our own allotted place, just like Daniel. So play your role well, but understand it is a spiritual battle, and we fight with spiritual tools. Our weapons are not against flesh and blood necessarily, as Paul tells us in Ephesians. Remember, a lot of people have angst. They are upset. They're lost. This is the time to be a positive light and witness. It is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. So as we wrap out the show this weekend before Thanksgiving, please have a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. Don't eat too much. We have much to be thankful for. It doesn't make any difference what problems we've got and always facing. People have been facing problems since the beginning. So remember, God is our fortress and our deliverer. Let us be thankful to him, okay? Do remember to pray for us, if you would, for provision and protection. Pray for those suffering for their faith around the world and for those in charge of our governments at all different levels, wherever you may happen to be during this time of transition and paradigm shift in the West. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller and our webmaster Brad Grant and our special events producer Kara Leffler, we're at steelonsteel.com. I'm John Leffler. The program is Steel on Steel.
This has been Steel on Steel with John Leffler, an alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Steel on Steel is produced by Carol Leffler, engineered by Brad Grant. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the staff, management, owners, or advertisers of this radio station. Steel on Steel can be heard 24 hours a day on the internet at steelonsteel.com. CDs or online subscriptions support the ongoing program production. For more information, call toll-free 1-800-829-5646. That's 1-800-829-5646. This is the Steel on Steel Radio Consortium.